Captain Bill Todi, and this week's episode, I'm coming to you from the historic Royal Hawaiian Hotel. This week, we're bringing you Captain Todi's Pearl Harbor. No visit to Pearl Harbor is complete without a visit to the Pacific Submarine Force Museum at the historic sites of Pearl Harbor, where the USS Bowfin is housed. So visit with Chuck Merkel, who's been featured on one of our other podcasts, and we're going to tour the USS Bowfin in a way that you would not be able to do otherwise, and the Pacific Submarine Force Museum. Unfortunately, at this point in the podcast recording, I suffered a rookie mistake when the battery on my lapel microphone died, so you're going to have difficulty hearing me. It's picked up a bit on Chuck's microphone. Good news is the important information is provided by Chuck, and his microphone worked fine. So I apologize for that, but let's press on. We're with Chuck Merkel here today. He is the
executive director
of both the USS Bowfin Museum and the Pacific Submarine Force Museum. Yep. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you'll remember, Chuck, from our episode on the Submarine Medal of Honor recipients from World War II, where we went through a bunch of those. That was a great time, Chuck.
Thanks. Yeah, I enjoyed it too, Bill.
Yeah, Chuck was here in Hawaii, and I was in Florida when we reported that. Seth was in, Mississippi. But now I'm in Pearl Harbor, and we are standing in front of the Bowfin. Now, give us some background on the Bowfin, Chuck.
Okay, sure. So Bowfin was the third ship in the Baleo class, which had the deeper depth capability of 400 feet from 300 feet. She was launched at Portsmouth Naval Shipyard on December 7th, 1942. And she was named Pearl Harbor. So, 1 year after the attack.
Okay.
And she was named for a freshwater fish that's native to the Mississippi drainage in North America that's notably very aggressive nighttime shallow water predator. So pretty appropriate name for a submarine. And she commissioned on 1st of May, 1943, so she's just over 80 years old right now. And during the course of 9 war patrols here in the Pacific, she lived up to her namesake and her nickname. She claimed 44 vessels sunk. In the final accounting, she ranks in the mid-teens in both number of ships and amount of tonnage sunk during the war.
And what was that nickname?
The Pearl Harbor Avenger.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because she was launched on December 7th, or commissioned on December 7th?
Launched.
Launched.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, she did her part in avenging Pearl Harbor.
Certainly did.
Yeah. Great. So we're going to go inside and take a look around like nobody else can.
Right,
Chuck, this
right.
is obviously a working museum, so
yes.
we're going to have people going by, but that's great because it means people are learning, right?
That's fact.
Yeah.
All right. We're up on the forward main deck of Bowfin, and I don't know if you could pan the camera down. We're a long way above the top of the pressure hull.
Mm-hmm.
The pressure hull itself is 16 feet in diameter. And all of this area was free flood. And you really had to think of Bowfin as a small surface ship that could submerge for brief periods.
It's true for all the World War II, all diesel submarines even today.
Right. That's fact. So immediately behind us here, if you want to pan, during her modifications middle of the war, this high-frequency sonar system was added onto the ship. So there's one piece of it on this side, and the other side was the other piece. So that was used for mine detection. And on Bowfin's 9th war patrol, she went into the Sea of Japan with 8 other submarines.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time we'd been in the Sea of Japan since the loss of the Wahoo in October of 43.
Right.
And it had been Admiral Lockwood's goal to get back in the Sea of Japan. And really, by the end of 44, there weren't very many targets worthy of torpedoes anymore.
Yeah,
and the Sea of Japan was about the last bastion that they had.
Yeah, there's some in the Formosa Strait, Taiwan Strait, right where O'Kane and Barb were lost.
Right.
O'Kane wasn't lost, but the Barb was. The Sea of Japan, slim pickings.
Yes, so they Admiral Lockwood's goal was to train and certify these 9 ships. We know all 9 of them made it into the Sea of Japan. They dispersed around the Sea of Japan. And on a set date, they started executing their attacks. They then rendezvoused at the northern end of the Sea of Japan and came back here to Pearl Harbor on the 4th of July, 1945.
All 9 made it out.
Only eight made it out.
Only 8.
And the Bonefish.
La Perouse, where Wahoo was lost.
Correct,
right?
Correct.
Okay.
And they know
Bonefish didn't make it.
Bonefish was lost in that patrol on her way out, but the other eight came back.
Was it mines for Bonefish?
I'm not sure that they've ever figured out what it was.
Right.
That's another one of those mysteries. So.
Yep. Now, the deck guns, talk to us about that.
So initially, Bofin had a 4-inch gun. It was back here on where this round plate is. The mount's still there. But during her major maintenance period, I'll call it, here on the West Coast of the United States, this gun was removed and a 5-inch gun was added to the stern. This gun really didn't have that much punch, and so with a 5-inch gun, and Bofin carried out quite a few surfaced attacks with that gun. That's probably one of the main reasons she didn't get a lot of credit for some of the vessels she sank, because they were too small to be evaluated and credited.
Yeah, in the post-war evaluation where we tallied and balance the scorecard. Yeah, those small boats, which were critical to the war effort because they carried a lot of supplies. You know, a lot of the boats didn't get credit for those kills.
Right.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
So you want to go inside?
Let's head down. So this stairway obviously wasn't here when Bofin was in commission, but this was how weapons were shipped down into the forward torpedo room, set on the deck, tilted up to match the angle, and then down into the room they came.
Mm-hmm. It's from the conning tower, so unlike you see on movies,
right.
Fire one, fire two, one fired electrically.
Right.
But the torpedo men were also back here,
right,
firing them manually in case
if needed to. Yeah, see those red button, plunger button on each tube.
Right here
was how that would be launched.
Yeah, here. So it seems so. As they're pushing the plunger in the conning tower,
they're ready to
shoot.
Ready
well.
To go. Yep.
Pushing it now to manually fire in case electric firing mechanism doesn't
right.
work.
So, yep. So here in the forward torpedo room, there's 6 torpedo tubes, all arranged 3 to a side of the bow vertically. Could carry a total of 16 weapons here in the room, 6 preloaded in the tubes, and then another 10 reloads in the stows.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually 3 reloads down beneath the deck we're standing on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no hydraulics to operate any of these right. systems, so everything was manpower.
Block and tackle.
We'd still figured out the interlock system, so there's interlocks to keep the inner and outer door from being open at the same time.
Which would be bad.
That would be a really bad day. But I always like to point out these tubes are 21 inches in diameter, and this is exactly the same as all of our modern ships, except the Seawolf class.
Right.
So our modern weapons are basically the same size as our World War II weapons.
Mark 14s were, yeah.
Right.
And, you know, in the torpedo room, the torpedo men would also set depth.
Right.
Run depth.
Right.
And but they couldn't, in real time as they're loading, decide whether it was going to be impact or influence, the magnetic
right.
explosive that
right.
had to be set.
Before loading,
right.
Right, so when the weapon got lined in the tube and the guide stud locked mm-hmm. with the stop bolt, they're actually mechanical shafts, so a lot of these gearing that you see that goes into the tube, 3 shafts actually connected to the torpedo.
Mm-hmm.
One was to set the speed high or low. You kind of, high was pretty much the default.
Yeah.
The depth was running depth. And then the final shaft was the gyro course.
Yeah.
And that shaft remained engaged, and the gyro course was continuously updated until standby was selected. And then when standby was selected for that tube, that shaft withdrew, and that was the final firing interlock to enable the tube to fire.
Yeah.
And you see the shiny piping here behind Bill. That's the impulse flask for the 6 torpedo tubes are actually up outside the superstructure, outside the pressure hole in the superstructure, and when the fire signal was given, the stop bolt rolled, and then air was pushed into the tube, and that's what ejected the weapon out.
Yeah. Modern torpedoes, we use water, and we push, we have a ram that pushes impulse water, so it shoots out with water, not air, which makes it less detectable.
Right.
But back then, it was 100% air. They'd need to recharge those air flasks,
right.
which meant that it's something that they would do once they surfaced, because you can't recharge.
Well, they had high-pressure air flasks, so they could
right.
recharge from there, but you know that was their, at the end of the day, when they had to surface.
Yeah.
And their goal at the end of the, before the sun came up in the morning, was batteries fully charged, air banks topped off, made as much fresh water as you can, final thing they would do was throw their trash overboard in weighted bags, and then they would do a trim dive to make sure they were ready for the day. So that air bubble, you didn't want that air bubble to come out. It would be like a big burp coming out in the water. You're only a half a mile away from your target. Good chance of being seen. So there's actually a relief valve on each tube that was designed to vent that air back into the ship. Mm-hmm. Once that valve opened, it had to be manually shut. So among the many other things that was going on in here is the torpedo men had to watch for when water started to issue out of that pipe. It was time to shut that valve, and then that enabled them to shut the outer door, drain the tube, and then be ready to reload and go again.
Fantastic. Now, we talked about in, the Gene Flucky episode? Yeah, it was Gene Flucky and the barb, where the torpedo men were begging him to shoot some torpedoes so that, in the after torpedo room so that they would have a place to sleep.
Right.
These are real world issues.
Right, that's right.
Real world constraints, and he did indeed shoot some after torpedoes to get more berthing space.
Right. Yeah. And I do think, too, that I think that they didn't have much of a record. They hadn't, until he took over, the barb had not been a very success, had not had many successes, if any. And the aft torpedo room had never felt like they'd ever contributed, so they really wanted to make that shot from an aft tube. That's a big morale booster. I can't tell you how much that is to do that sort of thing. So,
thanks, Chuck.
All right.
See what we can help. What else we can see in the ship?
All right. Sounds good. I mean, as you well know, Bill, there's a multiple purposes for every space in the room, and the torpedo room's no exception. The forward escape trunk's located here in this torpedo room. The officer's head or shower in the back corner, and that passive sonar system is actually shifted down here during the modification because the FM sonar was put in its place in the conning tower. All right. So here is, I kind of already mentioned the officer's bathroom and shower was back here in the corner.
I'm sure you were.
And this officer's head. Right, that's fact. They didn't have his own. And these two shiny shafts was how the hydrophones from the main sonar system were lowered down below the ship when the ship was submerged. And then with this switch, they could rotate the head around, but it's equivalent of putting a cone around your ear and listening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you equate that to our modern ships, the ships Bill and I served on, 1,200 hydrophones on a 16-foot diameter sphere at the front end of the ship. And this was all oral processing. You had to be listening in that direction to capture that sound. So the next compartment is technically called the forward battery compartment because one of the two main batteries is under the deck. So on Bowfin, there were 120 cells in each of two battery compartments. Later ships had 126, and that's what you and I had on our boat, so 126 cells. And one battery, that's right. And we'll step into the wardroom, mm-hmm. And just forward of the wardroom is the pantry. And on submarines, still true today, everybody eats the same food. Mm-hmm. So the food came from the galley, was kept warm up here in the pantry and served. Mm-hmm. And it was important that the coffee was always warm So this is where the officers ate their meals, talked about the day, relived the attacks, mm-hmm. Played cribbage and other pastimes, but there probably wasn't a whole lot of relaxing when they were on a war patrol.
No, but cribbage was a spectacular, still is on mm-hmm. submarines, yep. pastime. I was never a good cribbage player, so the captain would always want to play me because he figured he was going to win.
Yep.
Later when I was captain, I just didn't play at all.
Right.
Now, we still had stewards on submarines, right?
Yes. So,
we just released a book about the USS Indianapolis stewards called mm-hmm. Heroes in the Shadows. Mm-hmm. But it's important to note, there were a couple of cooks, the cook for everybody, including the officers.
Right.
But there was also one?
Probably a couple stewards that were assigned in here. You know, and so I don't, can't candy coat it. It was the way it was.
Yeah.
You know,
Filipino or African American.
Right. Yeah, they were segregation. Mm-hmm. I know O'Kane talks very fondly about his steward. Mm-hmm. Always had a cup of coffee. I guess he was quite the poker player.
He was the last one on board when they were leaving any port somewhere, carrying all the cruise money winnings.
Yeah.
It must have been quite a character. He, unfortunately, from what I've read in books, he attempted an escape but didn't survive.
Right. He embolized or something on the way up and was dead by the time he got to the surface. And, and again, same with the Indianapolis stewards. None of the certain cooks survived the sinking. This is an incredible place. Now, the radio that's up there, was that a short wave?
Yeah, so that was short wave radio. So at night they could tune in and listen to Tokyo Rose or whoever else might have been broadcasting.
Yeah.
All the charts were kept in here in these lockers. Mm-hmm. I don't think too many people on board the ship knew where the submarine was going until they had left Midway. When they got underway from Midway, they finally were able to say where they were headed.
Yeah. One of our viewers, Chuck, asked the question about why they blamed Admiral King for this, where we kept a squadron of submarines operating out of Australia. It was in the Perth, Australia area, where there's still the submarine base today, rather than moving all the submarines to Pearl Harbor. It's 1.5 times as far from Pearl Harbor to the operating areas as it is from Australia. But beyond there, were there other issues?
What wound up in Australia was the remnants of Seventh Fleet, of what was in the Philippines, and the slow retreat down
Cavite in the Philippines.
Right. So when they abandoned the Philippines and down to Jakarta, and then eventually the Houston and Adelaide, I think, whatever that
Adelaide.
The Australian cruiser that drove right into the Japanese invasion fleet. It's soon to strike.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a commitment to Australia that we had that facility down there. We didn't have all our eggs in one basket. At that point, Midway wasn't secure, so we couldn't really rely on Midway as a refit base.
Yeah. And I pointed out that even Lockwood had been the admiral in Australia,
right,
submarine fleet, when he became sub-pack after English died. He didn't move those submarines from Australia to Pearl Harbor,
right,
even though he was in Pearl Harbor. He kept them there.
Right.
And today, we're learning the strategic value of Australia vis-a-vis China.
Right.
So it's an issue that's, I think, fairly well resolved, the value of that strategic location.
Right. Now, I know I've given you a tour before, and I don't remember whether it's before or after I figured out what this was, but look up over your head. You see all those bolts?
Yeah. Well, where is it?
See all those bolts in that plate?
Sure.
That's the pressure hull.
Really?
So that's a bolted plate in the pressure hole, and it's immediately above the battery access hatch. So every year they had to replace their batteries. I mean, these batteries were either charging or discharging. It wasn't like our It wasn't like our nuclear submarine where we trickle discharge and then charge once a week.
Yeah.
Those batteries, they were either charging or discharging. So over a year, they were in pretty bad shape. So to expedite the replacement, they could pull that plug. And there's one over the aft battery well as well. We'll see that in the cruise berthing. And I've actually found a third bolted plate. It's aft of the conning tower. I'm not sure what it was for yet. I haven't figured that out yet. But there were actually three bolted plates like that.
They could pull one cell at a time, right?
Right. Just like how we did, 1,500 pounds a piece.
1,500 pounds a piece.
Yeah.
That's a major effort to replace a battery. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
I've done it twice in my career. Yeah.
Yep. And, now they don't even have a battery charging lineup anymore with the new batteries that we have in place.
I didn't know that. Of course, that's Virginia class.
And even on 688s and Tridents are all backfitted with this new style. Basically, nobody could afford to produce these batteries anymore, so they made a transition.
Okay. Now we're so happy to have Chuck leading this tour, because this is not an area that's known, that the general public is permitted in, Chuck. And so we are in the conning tower of the Bowfin. Now, I've separately filmed the inside of the conning tower of the Parchy.
Okay.
And so, but this is, that's been removed from the actual submarine. This is still in the submarine.
Right.
Chuck, what can you tell us about the conning tower?
So the conning tower is a separate 8-foot diameter pressure hole that was located immediately above the control room. So there's a hatch that has access down into the control room, and then there's an access hatch up to the bridge above us.
Mm-hmm.
All the equipment to fight the ship is up in this compartment. There's an auxiliary home station. So during battle stations, the helmsman would be up here at this station, and this is actually a mechanical linkage that connects to the main helm. The shafts go outside the pressure hole and articulate down. So the amount of the number of pressure hole openings and penetrations on this ship would make a modern submariner very, very, very nervous.
Because there's packing in that.
So stuffing tubes, and all those crazy things. So everything for the helm, so he was immediately available to the captain if the captain was up here in the conning tower during a submerged approach, or if he was on the bridge for a surfaced approach.
Now, we didn't have color CRTs back in those days. For red rather than rigging for gray.
Correct.
Same when we were junior officers.
That's right.
The only CRTs were green screen. Right. We would rig for red.
Right.
And all of these indicators here are configured to be visible when it's rigged for red for night surface attack. And during a submerged attack, of course, you could be rigged for white.
Or if it was dark, you'd want to have everything down. It turned off or red anyway. So so I mentioned earlier the passive sonar system used to sit here, and in fact, in the Parchi conning tower, it still does because Parchi never had this modification installed. But this was the high-frequency FM sonar that was used for the minefield avoidance and penetration.
Did it work?
It worked. They got through. We had some testimony from some bowfin sailors before they passed that they heard cables go down the side of the hull. But we know all nine of those submarines made it into that Sea of Japan.
Incredible.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Good. And this is basically as sophisticated as radar was in those days.
Right. That's it.
Yeah, it's a little CRT, so this is a PPI display.
Yes, yeah. And at the beginning of the war, all you got was a range. You didn't get a bearing.
Right.
It was like a little blip. It would be a whole ring, or you would get an A-lit sort of thing, like our
A-scan,
like our old narrowband system in the day, the same sort of thing.
Right.
These were the firing panels up here, so the forward one here with the six sets of buttons was for the forward room, and then the back one was for the aft room. So this would be lined up, whichever was next to fire, and as the lights turned red and everything was ready to go, these plungers, this was the solenoid that actually fired the tube.
So you would go to standby on the switch, and then
that lined it up.
That lined it up. So there would only be one at a time on standby, And then so whatever that is on standby, then you hit
punch.
The and when you go to standby, of course, the torpedo course rod is disengaged to allow the torpedo
engaged.
To be
That's right.
Okay. And very cool.
Yep.
So, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that we kind of fed ourselves on in the old days. Yeah, we still, at least when I was a submariner, called the thing that caused the bearing to be transmitted from the periscope into the fire control system, we didn't call it TDC, the pickle.
That's it.
And this is why it was called the pickle, folks, because this is what you would squeeze to get the bearing from the periscope into the torpedo data computer, which is right there.
Right.
And so I described this as an analog computer because I wanted to make folks understand that computers did not start in the digital age. We actually had analog computers in the day.
Right. So there were two pieces to the torpedo data computer. The aft piece was the position keeper, and that was where the solution of the contact that we're going to attack was dialed in. And then the forward end was the angle solver. So it would solve for the gyro angle for either the aft torpedo tube attack or forward torpedo tube attack. And you got a light when things were within limits, and that would allow you to execute the attack.
And within limits means the intercept point is within the constraints of the gyro angle limits on the torpedo.
Correct.
The torpedo can't turn more than a certain amount of degrees.
Right.
Okay.
And I think, you know, most of the really successful guys were the ones that learned to point their tube where they wanted their torpedo to go, minimize the gyro angle, because that turn introduces a advance and transfer, and that was difficult to calculate, and you were better off taking all of that out. I mean, if you think about it, more than about a degree of error in your solution meant you were going to miss.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing that they could even hit it all when you really think about what they had to go through. Now, Bill and I, we both grow up with Mark 19 plotters in our submarines. And this was an even earlier version of a Mark 19 plotter. So this device was electromechanical device. It took input for our own ship's course and speed, and then it drove a little position bug, and every minute the plotter on his station in here would mark the bug. Nowadays, of course, this is all CRT driven. We don't have to do any of that stuff.
But this is basically an electronic dead reckoning device.
Right, correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Correct.
And so, again, I think I made this point in one of our earlier episodes that when we were both junior officers, we had the Mark 113 Mod 10 fire control system, which was very similar to what you're seeing here.
That's right.
Hand cranks.
That's right.
They were analog computers with hand cranks where we would dial in the, you know, our projected course speed of the target.
That's right.
And range. And then the computer would, the analog computer would calculate torpedo parameters.
That's right.
To the intercept point. Yeah. So that was the early 80s, folks. So
that's right.
From the 40s to 80s, 40 years, we hadn't progressed very much.
Nope, that's a fact. All right.
Great. Thank you.
Great.
And immediately across from the captain's stateroom is the department head stateroom. So there was a desk. You'll also note there were no doors on any of these staterooms. There was a rod here for curtains. Yeah, no doors in here.
So that's the department head stateroom.
Four department heads were right across from the captain. So
engineer, torpedo officer, and navigator.
He could reach across the passageway and snap his finger.
Right.
And a five berthing space. This is for the chief petty officers. And, of course, this obviously would have been a stainless steel cover, but every locker on a submarine has keys. They needed to make sure that if they put a spare part in a certain place, that it would...
accessible to everybody.
...knew where it was, and...
And the yeoman shack.
Typewriter?
Yep. And, of course, the radioman also had their typewriter.
All right. In the next compartment here is the control room. So this is the main helm station. So the most junior, one of the first qualifications for the junior sailors was
helmsman.
Qualify helm. And the helmsman, he's steering the ship based on the orders from the captain or also deck, but you can't see where he's going. So he uses his gyro compass down here to maintain the course, and he controls the rudder. There was a angular indication for rudder indication, and this was the backup. These lights would light depending on the position of the rudder.
Rudder angle indicator.
Engine or telegraph, so two shafts, so 2 engine or telegraphs. When the captain or officer deck would order a speed change, that helmsman would position these pointers to the new order. That would ring a bell in the maneuvering area, and electricians would position their pointer to indicate that bell was answered and being executed.
And of course, they didn't worry about cavitations. There was no all ahead flank cavitate. All flanking was always cavitated.
That's right. This was the main enlisted, senior enlisted watch station during the war to monitor the Christmas tree board. So these lights were red and green to indicate red meant open or danger, and green meant safe or shut. And it was this man's responsibility to continuously monitor the readiness to dive. During daylight hours, at a feeling of threat, an emergent dive would be ordered, and the vents were open without everything turning green. And you just relied on everybody's training to rig and get everything shut.
On a modern submarine, it generally takes 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, depending on,
right. Yeah. And these guys would have to do it in 45 seconds.
The goal was to be completely underwater in less than a minute.
Right.
So they practiced with each watch team, so they were ready to do that. And there's no doubt we probably lost the submarine or two to an accident like that, because we don't know what happened to all 52 of those submarines.
Right.
We know we left men topside. Men were left and swept into the sea and lost that way. So.
Okay, the induction valve, which is the intake for the diesels, is a huge opening hole. If you don't get that shut before it goes underwater, there's a lot of water coming into the submarine.
You'll see these valves have different shaped handles. So that was so in darkness the men could know which one they were operating. And the bow and stern planes were operated from these two wheels. On that emergent dive, the lookouts who were up on the bridge were the first two men down from the bridge, and they manned the bow planes and the stern planes.
So if you look out below, they jumped down to the conning tower.
Right. They had basically one. They had like 25 feet vertical from their stations up on the bridge. Come down and man. The junior off the deck who'd been in the conning tower supervising the radar and the plot, he would come down and be the diving officer. So he backed up the man over here, chief of the watch, what we call him. We helped him get things straightened out here, and then he'd make sure he wanted to get the ship under, but then he wanted to be in control underwater as well. And the critical tank in that hall was a negative tank. So this tank was kept full on the surface, as well as the safety tank was kept full on the surface. And when they did their trim dive before sunrise, they would mark this tank with a grease pencil mark where they had been neutrally buoyant on that.
So they blow negatives to the neutral point. So
he would come down, make sure the ship's getting underwater, making sure we're getting our everything rigged appropriately, and then assess, get the ship completely underwater, and then he would blow that tank to that mark. If that didn't arrest the descent, he could continue to blow that tank. He had the safety tank then as a backup. Once that was empty, all you had was blowing the ballast tank, which we, of course, didn't want to do.
Okay.
Thank you. Yep. The down underneath this yellow compartment is the pump room.
Mm-hmm.
So air compressors, hydraulic plant, air conditioning, refrigeration, all auxiliary equipment down in that space.
And those machinist meets then as well?
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, so we're now in the galley crew's mess. So a meal every 6 hours cranked out of this little small kitchen.
Is there a cook and a baker?
There was a night baker generally, so a cook. But there would be a meal every 6 hours. Basically, when the meal was ready, the oncoming watch team would come in and eat and then relieve the watch, and then the off-going men would come down and eat.
Were they generally three-section?
Yeah, three-section.
Rather than port and starboard.
And I think most of them learned to sleep during the day.
Yeah.
When they were going to be busy and active at night.
The science of watch section is interesting.
Yes.
I think some of our British friends are still like port and starboard today, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, and now we're standing 8-hour watches.
Yeah,
they do that or not.
3 8-hour watch sections. 24 hours of fullness.
Okay.
Back in our day, we had 3 6-hour watch sections, right? And which makes an 18-hour day, which meant our body clock never adjusted. Our body clock was always screwed up. That circadian rhythm doesn't work when your body's in your watch is on 18-hour schedule. It took a lot of scientific studies to finally convince.
Yeah.
It's
really perfect.
The propulsion program.
Well,
that's easy. Yeah, it's good.
The mess deck's feeding for 24, which was basically about a third of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And this locker down into this space was the armory. So all the small arms were stored down here, and the 5-inch shells were stored here, down in this locker.
And there we'd be passed up through the hatches.
So this scuttle right here was what the pass through was, how the shells would be sent up.
Mm-hmm.
So we get topside on the main deck, we'll see the other end of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the detonators and some ready shells were kept in the locker up on the main deck, ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the shells without their detonators were down here, they'd be passed.
They still have to load the detonators before they load them into the gun.
Right, that's right. Yeah, they got some ready shells.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they get everything else ready.
That'd take a lot of time.
Yeah. Wow.
But here we go. You'll get your great wolf. What's on that?
Well, there's some others throughout the place.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, scrimmage board.
There was a scrimmage board.
Yeah, the sailors. It wasn't just the officers who played scrimmage. It's the rest of the
team. Yeah. These are throughout the ship. And we've been in such a long day. We drive on the ship now. So, pictures from the night before patrol. And this was actually the evening that I saw. We had a big wrench, and hammer, plunger, big screwdriver, and toilet paper. Those were the guys that came down.
That's no respect. It's like a critical job.
Now this man here,
in the museum, we got a picture of him before they left Pearl Harbor at the end of the war. His nephew is a retired Marine.
That's right.
And he's our age. Notice the beard.
Yeah.
And that was just because it was so hard to shave when you're on patrol.
Yeah. freezer and dry storeroom were down below this grade area. They carry 60 days of provisions, and there'd be food everywhere, as you and I did the same.
You know, we would walk on food trying for 90 days.
That's right. Okay. The next compartment we'll head into is the berthing area for the crew. And underneath here is the other battery with 120 cells on both ends. Underneath here. Here's the other opening at the top to change out those battery cells.
Right.
And we've also had some number of things in our collection that we found some things in the boat as we were getting ready to go into dry dock last fall. So our curator put this display together. I think it's pretty neat.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Very cool.
So do we know who the crewman was and what you call?
Yes. I don't recall his name off the top of his head, but his name's actually in the...
This guy, Pappy Carvin, that's not a beard you can grow in one patrol.
No.
That's a serious beard.
Yeah, he did all 9 war patrols on the boat. He was a motor machines mate.
So really?
In addition to his beard, he was probably deaf.
Submersible Sam. Yeah, no kidding. On the inside of the cuffs, we had what were called Liberty patches. So you'd roll up your cuffs, and you could display, not regulation, but you would do that, roll up your cuffs, and you can display whatever port, Liberty port, you got your patch from, and it shows how salty you are.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, sandals, shorts, and T-shirts were the uniform underway, so that you didn't get heat rash and all those things, right?
Right.
We're all feeling it.
So this picture is taken at Pearl Harbor.
Sierra 6, I believe.
Which doesn't exist anymore.
All right, that didn't exist even when you and I were James. But you can see there's a destroyer escort on the other side of the pier. Bowman's flying all of her pennants for claimed attacks. She's flying her battle flag from the aft periscope. And in the World War II gallery, there's a picture of the crew mustered on top of Bowfin. We'll take a look at that when we go in the museum.
Great.
But she was also flying her homeward bound pennant. Mm-hmm. And by tradition, that's a foot long for every sailor on board. That pennant's then cut into 12-inch pieces and given to each crew member. And here's 3 pieces of that pennant that we have in our collection.
Fantastic.
Pretty amazing screen. Pretty amazing thing. You can see it, you know, kind of flash into some of these bunks. Some of these were more preferred than others. You would only wake up and snap to alert once in here.
That's right. You hit your head.
But you can certainly see that there were some bunks that were much better than others. Mm-hmm. And this was a main passageway, so it's really why the torpedo rooms were more preferred berthing areas.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse us. Through this space is the officer's
quarters. Actually, you know, I'm noticing here, Chuck, that when I was an ensign, there's more space in this guy's overhead, this bunk, than I had when I was on my first boat.
Yep.
And so this doesn't suck in a submarine stand.
No, even this one's
stable. Yeah, probably did. Crew's head and showers in here,
mm-hmm.
and the washing machine was in here, but it was very rarely used.
Right.
This is probably one.
Main engine rooms. Bowfin had 4 main engines. Each engine was 1,600 horsepower. And our fleet submarines were considered diesel electric submarines. So the diesel generators ran and they turned DC generators that produced the power to charge the batteries. And then there were 4 electric motors that turned the 2 propeller shafts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why she was called a diesel electric submarine. At the forward end of this engine room are the 2 stills. Electric stills, they used electric energy to heat salt water to about 170 degrees. There was a partial vacuum drawn on that water so that it flashed to steam, and then the condensate was recondensed as fresh water. And all
All the nuclear submarines that Bill and I served on used that same device as a backup means of making fresh water.
The main, the evaporator was 10,000 gallons a day on our submarines,
right.
But most of that was for the reactor.
That's right.
And we had a backup evaporator like
that's
this.
Right.
Yep. And so there was no direct drive to the
correct,
shaft.
No direct drive.
It was motor.
Diesel electric, that's right. Mm-hmm. So it would have been very, very loud in these compartments when the engines were running. The air that came from the induction piping that ran under the superstructure topside into each room, there was also an opening that gave air into the maneuvering area. Mm-hmm. But that valve wasn't very high off the surface anyway, and you could take water down through. Not much freeboard there. So I can only imagine the noise in here and then the heat, residual heat after shutting down. Two more main diesel engines in here, and then under the deck plates in here is a small auxiliary diesel. So she could make 20, 21 knots on the surface. If she needed all four mains for propulsion, the aux diesel could charge the batteries. Mm-hmm. Anytime you're on the surface, you wanted to charge the batteries because you didn't know how long you were going to be on the surface, and then you didn't know how long your next dive was going to be. So you always wanted to...
You could align any of the diesel engines to battery charge.
Correct.
And maximize the battery charge.
That's right.
So you could align all four to propulsion and still charge with the oxygen.
That's correct. The next compartment is a maneuvering room. So as you go by the cabinet, you'll see all of the switch gear and wiring. So all the power generated by the generators pass through this cube. So you can kind of get a feel for the bus work and all the rheostats in here. And the electricians then stood their watch at the aft end of this compartment.
And the switches were essentially manual, but...
Right.
It's all DC, so they didn't need to parallel buses.
That's right. That's correct. Didn't need to parallel anything. So there was one big switch for each of the four main generators, and then they could align for either turning the propellers. So the electric motors are underneath the cube. There's a set of reduction gears for each shaft under here, and then two shafts for propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of things that are of note as I've let these folks pass through, and I'll show you a couple things on these breakers was quite a discovery here for me, another eye-opener. And we'll swap with you, Karen.
And it's funny how much stuff we have to actually discover.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I learn something every day. So these breakers are DC. There's no power in here, so we have people operating these all the time. But these breakers had a mechanical...
Lock
to lock them open.
Yeah.
And, it was that point of if this equipment doesn't run, the ship's going to sink.
Right.
So, run it till it burns up.
Lock them shut.
Lock them shut so the equipment energized.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, so need
basically this.
This
is battle override.
That's right. This is a battle short.
Yeah.
Mechanical battle short on those
How
breakers.
About that? Incredible.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. And here's the engine air motor telescope.
Other end of the
heater.
Right.
So, port and starboard port, and so when the helmsman rings up the bell, the motor machinist then answers the bell,
right?
And by ringing up the same bell, and this is on battery. How did they control speed on with the engines?
So they could adjust with these. This was how they would see how all of them are lined up together. This is how they could adjust the RPM on the four engine to adjust the field. All
so
together.
Basically, change the RPM in the engines to change the voltage.
Right.
To change the
speed output.
Turns.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
I mean, there were rheostats to increase speed here and increase the voltage too for battery charging. Mm-hmm. But then they generally this would how they'd fine tune the engine speed and shaft speed.
I see. Okay.
And then this was the direct outlet from the induction piping down into this cube, and I think. Most faint, the Wahoo took a big slug of water down that coming out of on one of her patrols and was dead in the water for hours because they shorted everything out in this cube. So,
electrical switches.
Right. I think they were almost to the point of ready to scuttle if they couldn't get moving.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're now in the aft torpedo room. There were a couple of small office spaces or operating spaces in here. We've got one of these set up with quite a bit of equipment. One of the things we've just put in here is another thing that BOFIN got added later in the war was the ability to carry electric torpedoes.
Mm-hmm.
So the battery chargers for those torpedoes, there were some in the forward torpedo room, but that's the charger that was here in the aft torpedo room.
Mark 18?
Mark 18, and then also the Cutie was electric.
Okay, Cutie, C-U-T-I-E.
Yeah, right. I know it has a designation, but I...
Now, I talk about these counter-rotating screws mm-hmm. as it pertains to Japanese midget submarines.
Right.
And this very small rudder. But yep. These rudders aren't very big either.
No, they're not.
On the Mark 14.
And then most of the body of the torpedo is an air tank.
Right.
So this whole thing was charged to about 2,000 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And during the loading process, this lever was cocked. So it was put in back position.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the weapon left the tube, this popped up,
mm-hmm.
and that ported the air into the various service. So it got the turbine motor running.
Mm-hmm.
It spun up the air spun gyro, and the other shafts that were connected were up here in this area, so a couple different places. So that was
depth
course, and speed.
And speed.
So those were how those mechanical shafts were made.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically the weapon left the tube, came up to its speed, came to its running depth, and turned to that gyro course, and then it ran until it hit something or ran out of air.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the air-driven steam torpedo, it left a bubble trail. So, right, so that was another, on a calm day, alert lookouts might see that bubble trail. And, of course, that pointed back to right where you were, where your firing ship was.
Yep.
And you're not very fast, so you're not very far away from that firing location. So it was a dead giveaway. So the Mark 18 torpedo then basically replaced this air body with the batteries. Of course, the Mark 18 was much slower than the Mark 14 torpedo.
35 knots.
Right, and limited range compared to the
steam. And then these are the four aft torpedo tubes, and again, they're going to be broken here.
Right.
Here's a bump. But, more sailors on your own space. And so that's a problem. That's why.
Right.
Torpedoman asked Rocky to shoot some aft tubes.
Right.
Torpedoes.
And then this was actually the most preferred berthing for the crew.
Mm-hmm.
For a number of reasons. One, you're a long way. That main berthing area is a passageway.
Yeah.
So a lot of coming and going. It's right forward of the engine rooms, so they're running.
Waking up.
And probably the most notable is it's the furthest away from the wardroom and the officers. So it was a long trek back here for the officers to come back. And
Yeah,
you and I can laugh. And anyway, it's so the chief of the boat, as we still to this day, sets the crew's berthing bill. So
yep.
He was the guy to keep in the good graces.
Yeah. He probably wants to put the most responsible sailors back here.
Right.
Since they're
isolated. Could be very isolated. So another interesting note, and it applies to both the forward and the aft torpedo room, is these two pipes, one here and then one on the other side, you can't see it quite as well, but those are the vents for the number 7 main ballast tank. So the vent piping to those tanks
goes through the hull,
both on number 1 and the forward torpedo room as well. Bolted flanges, and one of the speculations of the loss of a lot of the submarines on their first patrols from Portsmouth Naval Shipyard was that these joints weren't made up well. And so, and I think there's another one further down right at the base. It's kind of hard to dig back down in there, but there's speculation that those weren't made up well, and that's a big hole. There's no way to seal it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to flood the whole compartment, and we've come a long way in our 123 years of submarining.
Right.
But
well, after loss of pressure, we could be blamed on brazed joints.
Right.
Flanged joints, but brazed, and seawater piping is welded.
Right, and then the air piping with filters in it, too, that probably froze the lines, froze the blow lines.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so that's below decks.
Yep.
All right, so we're standing here at the stern of the Bowfin. Beautiful day here in Pearl Harbor. You get quite an
Most days, by the way.
Yeah, it's very true. So it's pretty beautiful view. You can see the Arizona Memorial here in the background, the Missouri behind where the Arizona rests. And those white quays are where all the battleships were moored on the morning of December 7th.
Right.
And the brown tower over here to the side is the submarine escape trainer. That was deactivated before I...
1983. I went through
it. Did you go through it? You did it. I didn't get a chance to do it.
Somebody died and they...
That was the end of it,
huh? That was the end of that, right.
No, that was deactivated before my time, but so compared to the roundness of our modern submarines, here you got this nice flat deck, and it seems like we're a long way above the water, and we are for now, but when Bowfin was in commission, the water line was basically the bottom of the superstructure.
We're a lot
above the surface of the water than we would have been. And these black ports were added when the ship was decommissioned so that we could access the ballast tanks. The louvers on the bottom of all the ballast tanks were sealed shut, so there's no water. So that's another reason we sit higher, a lot higher in the water than when the ship was in commission.
It's worth saying the Tridents have a superstructure as well.
Right.
When I was XO of USS Florida, I had to make a couple of penetrations into the superstructure at sea, which was pretty scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yep. Well, you know, with the our fleet submarines would carry fuel in some of the ballast tanks, mm-hmm. and once those were then transferred that fuel into the internal tanks, they could convert those tanks to ballast tanks, and men had to go under the superstructure to complete that conversion.
Yeah.
We lost men during that on some ships. So here's the 5-inch gun, and it's got a stainless steel liner in the barrel, so it could be submerged and not be
corroded.
Mm-hmm. So just for reference, this is the other end of the pass-through for the 5-inch shells.
How did they get them up here?
So it was like a rammer of some sort. Mm-hmm. The ready shells and the detonators were in those lockers. This stairway wasn't here, of course.
Of course.
So there'd be a man for azimuth, a man for elevation, a gun captain. The shell would come up, it'd be loaded, the breech would be shut, and then the men learned how to time the roll of the ship, mm-hmm. so when they would release their round.
There's no gyro stabilization.
No.
There was on surface ships,
yep,
but there wasn't on submarines.
Right.
Now, you said all of the detonators were kept up here. None of them went for inside.
Right, for safety, yep, okay. For safety. And then this is the base or the start of the induction pipe. Mm-hmm. So the induction valve is a 34-inch valve was in the base of the sail. So not very high above the water line, and it wasn't unheard of to take water through that line, and then this ran all the length of under the superstructure into the two engine rooms and on into the maneuvering.
34 inches, that's a lot of water that goes into the people tank.
Yeah, that's a fact. Let's climb up on the bridge.
Let's do that.
Best view in the world. 40 millimeter anti-aircraft gun. There's another 20 millimeter anti-aircraft gun on the forward end of the...
So Seth would know this, but I think this is the same 40 millimeter barrel that's on a Bowfin's butt mount.
Yeah.
Okay. And here's a target
bearing transmitter
right. TBT, not to be confused with the TDC,
right.
Torpedo Data Computer. And so we have.
So this was where the
one forward.
So this would be for the aft tubes, for the captain would line up the target and transmit the bearings down to an attack. Thing I always talk about here at this station is imagine Dick O'Kane on the night of 24 October when he's fired the 6 bow tubes and now he's run back here to line up his attack on the aft tubes, and one of his two battle stations lining these up, getting ready to go,
yeah.
And one of his two lookouts grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and said, "Captain, you don't have time for that anymore."
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the Clear the Bridge, it's a very subtle piece, but it's the most amazing example of forceful backup that...
And it's what we expect from all of our submarine
right.
sailors.
And he was... His two battle stations lookouts were his chief quartermaster and his chief bosun's mate. And the chief bosun's mate survived, and he was the last Tang survivor to pass fairly recently.
Yeah.
But he wound up retiring as a commander after the war. He served, okay. did his time, and then passed.
Talk about the cigarette bridge.
Yeah.
And here where the lookouts would stand.
Right. So these two perches were where the lookouts would stand. And most boats also used a crow's nest. They would climb even further up on calm days to maximize their height of eye.
It's a direction finding antenna up there.
Yes, right? Yes. And there's the radar horn. I think that's air search. And I think the other horn's been removed and we don't have it anymore. We have that other
antenna.
Yeah, VHF whip.
And spotlight that's also a signal light.
Right, that's right. And this is where the officer of the deck would stand his watch. He had this little platform up here. You can see the other anti-aircraft gun up forward of the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a speaker microphone, so he could make his reports and give his orders, align these switches for whichever station he wanted to call. There were call buttons for the wardroom and the captain. There was
TBT
up here and a gyro repeater. There was a speed indicator.
Mm-hmm.
And then the diving alarm for up here is right underneath here. So that could be sounded from here to initiate that emergency dive.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a collision alarm up over on the other side by there. And then the whistle could be sounded from that side too.
Right.
But this was no easy path. These men were standing up on these platforms. It was always the officer deck's responsibility to know how many men were up here on the bridge. And those two men would be the first to go below. Not a direct path either. They had to jump, go down and around this, down through that hatch, and then down the conning tower attached into the control room.
That's on the order, clear the bridge.
Right.
Lookouts below, they go down, and then officer of the deck last.
Last, and he'd pull the hatch shut and make the report, last man down, hatch secure. We still do that today.
Mm-hmm. Done that.
Done that a few times, yeah. Not with the water lapping over the hatch,
no,
but...
No. Well, Chuck, here we are in the museum. I hope I got my audio problems fixed. I had some audio problems while we were on the Bowfin, but hopefully this is going to work.
Okay, great.
This your museum covers not just World War II, but the Cold War as well.
Great.
As I walked through earlier, I was shocked that you have a reactor plant control panel in it, in the museum. My goodness, how far we've come since the Brickover days.
Absolutely.
When you and I trained, that would never be allowed.
No, nope, that's right.
So those of you who want to see what a nuclear reactor plant control panel looks like, at least in our era,
right,
can see it here in the Bowfin. But today we're focused on World War II.
Right. So first gallery in the new museum is a World War II gallery. We start on December 7th, 1941, when the Chief of Naval Operations issued his order to execute unrestricted air and submarine warfare against Japan.
Yeah.
And we found ourselves in a war that we weren't trained to fight.
No. And in fact, you know, we talked on our podcast about the fact that it's not clear FDR was involved in the decision to send that message.
Right.
Right. Germans were already involved, were already engaged in restricted submarine warfare.
Right.
Technically, it violated international law, and Admiral Stark, CNO, sent that message out. It was clearly the right thing to do.
Right.
But he probably didn't have the authority to do that.
No, that's an interesting discussion. And, you know, prior to that, our submarines were called fleet submarines because their intent was to operate as scouts for the mm-hmm. fleet, find the main battle force of the enemy and direct our main battle force for what would be a decisive engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, in the days as we studied what was going on out here, the realization was we were going to have to execute unrestricted warfare
right.
here in the Pacific.
Right.
And we were fortunate.
Disengaging the submarines from the fleet operations
right.
and letting them operate on their own.
That's right.
Mm.
I think, you know, we tried to employ that for the Battle of Midway. There were almost 20 submarines employed around Midway. Only one of them made any sort of
Nautilus.
A contribution.
Yeah.
And, at least one of them ran aground,
right,
and it was pretty much a failure. And at that point on, we abandoned that.
We were learning
that fleet piece. So
yeah. Good.
We started in here.
Mm-hmm.
This is a propeller from one of the mini subs that Japan tried to enter Pearl Harbor with.
Mm-hmm.
This was this came off the one that washed up on the beach at Bellows.
That's HA-19. I did a separate video, Chuck, where I walk around HA-19.
Oh, it's in Fredericksburg.
Nimitz Museum in Fredericksburg, yeah. Right? And I talk about how difficult it would have been to maneuver that submarine in Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have big rudders on our submarines, and that little midget had a very small yep. rudder. Now, you don't have a midget submarine here, but you do have a Kaiten.
Correct.
So we're going to want to look at that later
okay.
on.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this depicts the attack that the Award made on one of the other midget submarines. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was for years and years, the Award was discounted. And so that didn't happen. But the University of Hawaii actually found that midget sub
2003
off the mouth of Pearl Harbor,
mm-hmm.
and there was a bullet hole right where the Ward sailor said there
right
said
through
there was.
The sail.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This map lays out the Pacific at the beginning of the war mm-hmm. and shows the extent of Japan's advance into the Pacific island chains as they capitalized on the attack.
Yeah, it's a great map we did. San Cristobal, Guadalcanal, Florida Island, you know, Savo. Up here, we did, 12, 13 episodes on Guadalcanal.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, we've done maybe, we've got to be approaching 8 or 9 on submarines.
Great.
But, yeah, the advance up New Guinea, New Britain, Rabaul. So that's a great display of this expanse of
right.
the Japanese Empire
right.
at this point of the war.
And it really kind of shows, too, the vast distances. I mean, the scale of this is, you know, Hawaii, we've got Midway,
mm-hmm.
and then to reach mainland Japan, and then our Asiatic fleet that then retreated
mm-hmm.
from the Philippines through the Indonesia and eventually down to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
But just the vast distances that had to be covered and our submarines were initially went out. There was no damage on the submarine base. None of the submarines are here at Pearl Harbor were damaged.
I think we only had 6 submarines in port.
There weren't very many. There were a number of them that were on their way here.
Mm-hmm.
We had submarines on practice patrols at Wake and Midway. And there were some encounters with Japanese forces at Midway, but no engagement.
Mm-hmm.
But these submarines were then told, you know, go, but be very careful.
Mm-hmm.
Travel at 1 engine speed. Well, 1 engine speed, you're going to spend half your patrol time getting to station.
Then it's time to turn around.
Then it's time to turn around and come home.
Yeah.
They were told to stay submerged during hours of daylight, which if you're only putting your periscope every very frequently, your high to eye is not very good. And then these guys got blasted for doing what their bosses said to do.
Yeah.
So it was no wonder that there was quite a bit of...
They weren't very
effective. Quite a few guys, no real successes on those early patrols. And then those guys, essentially, when they were criticized that harshly, a lot of them folded and gave up.
That was the failure in tactics and failure in command. And again, we had a lot of submarine losses before the war. So we really rewarded skippers who operated the submarines in such a way right. that they wouldn't sink.
That's right.
Those are in a completely different skill set than you need during time of war.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us a while to figure that out.
Right.
And guys like Mush Morton.
Right. So this display shows some of the artifacts from the submarine Wahoo.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only surviving battle flag. So Mush Morton made that flag.
Himself.
He made mm-hmm. that flag. The bell, it was found in a foundry after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that was working in the foundry recognized the submarine it was from
mm-hmm.
and the significance, so rescued it, and it's on loan to us here.
Mm-hmm. He was so proud of this design
yeah.
that he made with the Japanese flag symbolized by the feathers in the Indian's cap that he personally stenciled
yep.
T-shirts for his crew members.
Right. Right. So here's actually his son, mm-hmm. Doug, wearing that shirt.
The miniature shirt, T-shirt.
Right,
yeah.
That's wearing that T-shirt.
Uh-huh.
And then some of the other things in here. This is the 28 and 29-point cribbage hands
mm-hmm.
and a chart of the Yellow Sea. And the chart's annotated where those two hands were dealt.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that cards are signed by the officers that were in the wardroom when it occurred. Incredible.
Pretty wow. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is.
This was donated by Dick O'Kane's widow after he
right.
passed.
Dick O'Kane was his XO.
Yep.
And yeah. And what a combination that was. We talk a lot in our episode on the Wahoo about Morton being smart enough to understand what his strengths were and what his weaknesses were. And, you know, using O'Kane, the genius, to fill in where he wasn't strong.
Right. So this is an area where we have a lot of the family items, some of the last letters between mothers and sons and wives and husbands, and some of those things from some of the many sailors who were lost. And we've got a lot more to catalog and scan, but this is something we rotate some of the items out quite a bit here, just because it's...
You know, movies often get this aspect wrong. When sailors were lost at sea, in a movie you see some guy in whites walking up to the door, knocking on the door to deliver the message to the mother personally with a chaplain, right? There were so many people being lost during the war. We couldn't do that.
Right.
We often notify them by telegram.
Right.
Imagine how devastating that would be. We went to the telegram, and people use telegrams for everything.
Right.
At any time you had a son at sea and somebody shows up, the telegram guy shows up, your heart has to sink.
Mm-hmm.
That home front aspect is all too incredible. And I love the fact
that
you show the blue star flag, which means you have a family member serving, and the gold star flag, which means you have a family member who was lost during the war.
Yep.
It's a great tribute here.
Yep. It's just, we'll just head over along this way. So it shows... Shows a lot of the various things. Somebody's qual book, sketchbook for
sketching systems.
Had to sketch the systems. And
did you have to sketch the hydraulic system?
Absolutely.
I did too, right? Air system.
Air system, trim and drain system.
People wonder what these dolphins mean, whether they're officer enlisted. They mean that you have learned how to, how each system on the submarine is constructed. And for officers, how to fight the submarine, how to actually, approach an attack with the submarine.
Yeah.
And so that's, again, something that the surface ship people, especially during the war, to some extent even today, didn't have an analog for.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Here's some of the, another pair of standals and some of the various certificates and more of the pinup girls that would be in the...
So there's a shellback certificate.
That was crossing the equator.
Crossing the equator. I'm a shellback, but, I can't imagine what the shellback ceremonies are like these days. You've got to be a lot tamer than they were.
That toned down significantly. Yeah. Here's some of the... This is actually a... One of the magnetic detonator. So there was one of the
things that didn't work.
Didn't work very well.
Mm-hmm. We did an entire episode on torpedo problems during the war as well.
Yep.
And I see a firing pin as well.
Yep.
And so, some of the issues here that caused our failures.
Yep. Just some of the things that are in our collection.
Mm-hmm.
Bofin had this chicken. That's a replica, but that was in maneuvering.
What was up with the chicken?
It was just, I don't know what the joke was, but, put young men together and give them some idle time, and they'll come up with something to have fun with. Some of these drawings and sketches, every crew has an artist, and these are some things. I think these are from the USS Ray.
Okay.
That talks about some of the things and the amount of time it took to draw. Here's
every crew
a
member.
Drawing of every crew member.
Yeah.
He could spend a long time looking at that. And
holy cow. The expression, there's going to be some nuance in every one of those crew members' drawings
that we
will not understand.
We also talk about, so these are some of the implements, I think there were at least two appendectomies performed on submarines. And although it was highly frowned upon, it was a matter of life or death. And
they didn't have the
antibiotics that we have today, generally how it would be treated today. Yep.
There's actually a picture. I don't know how well you'll pick it up on video. That's the growler when she arrived in Australia after Gilmore was lost before construction.
Yeah,
and then this was a little known story of on the USS Billfish, where coming up from Australia, coming up by Lombok and through Makassar Straits, was detected and under attack. And basically, everybody up in the conning tower gave up. Captain, the XO, just laid down on the deck and were going to let fate take its course. And the engineer was Lieutenant Charlie Rush. He was a diving officer, so he was down in the control room maintaining depth. And he was, and his chief electrician, John Rendernick, was in charge of maneuvering, and basically the crew was, most of the crew had given up. And Charlie Rush recognizes that the helm station up in the conning tower is no longer manned. That guy's laying on the deck, so he gets somebody on the helm to give a course to steer. The chief is rallying the DC party. They're using bucket brigade to move water.
Because there's a helm in the control room, so you get somebody in that helm.
Somebody to man the helm. The chief's manning a bucket brigade to move water to keep the ship trim. They're taking on water. One of their main engines or main motors in the maneuvering area, below the maneuvering area, has come off its mount, can't be used. They get that. They're breathing acrid air. You know, air is getting foul,
salt
really
water in
bad.
The battery.
And the lieutenant figures out they're following a bubble trail. And that was how they were finding them underwater. So he executes a maneuver that we now call the Williamson turn. And drives back through the bubble trail and manages
60 degrees, and as soon as your head swinging past 60 degrees, you reverse course to the right.
Right.
And then you're going down your old track.
And so shakes off the attackers, and then the sun finally goes down. They've gotten far enough away, and the submarine surfaces. They manage to get at least one diesel running so they can charge a battery, get more of them online. And this was early on their patrol. They actually continued their patrol. And on their way back into Australia, the lieutenant looks at the patrol report, and there's no mention of any of this in the patrol report. So he goes to the captain and tells the captain, says, if you don't tell the Commodore when we get back, I will. And to his credit, the captain went up and said, I'm done, and tapped out and is relieved. So that story, this story was lost to history until the late 1990s, when the chief, John Rendernick, who is now terminally ill, and the lieutenant went on, he served a full career, retired as a captain. So he initiates an effort to get the chief recognized for what happened all those years ago. And doesn't get the Silver Star in time for the chief before he passes, but got him awarded a Silver Star. And in the process, the lieutenant is awarded a Navy Cross.
In 2002.
Yeah.
Incredible story. I had not heard that story.
And and I actually met him, Charlie Rush. He came out here when I was in command. I gave him a tour of the Key West. And he was out for a reunion of one of the boats he served on. And they had a big busload of people and came. And he comes off the bus, and I met him on the pier. And he says, Captain, as I want to be honest with you, I call her my daughter. She's not really my daughter, and she's Australian. Is there a problem? And I said, no, welcome aboard. But I did get to meet him, and it was quite an honor to,
what a great
to meet
story.
Him. Yeah, it was. Yeah. But it leaves you to wonder how many others are like that, you know, that were, you know, never ever told.
Some of the boats never came back.
That's right.
You don't know why or how.
So this, if you remember down on the boat, I showed you that picture of the welcome aboard pennant.
Yep.
So this was taken from the wing wall of that surface ship on the other side of the pier. And I can't really tell how many submarines every time I try to count, but all the finger piers were here, right? So somewhere on there, you stare at this long enough, you can figure out that I think this is Sierra 6.
Okay.
So there's seven on the other side of the pier and then 8 and 9. So that'd be 4 and 5 and 3, or 2 and 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. But this
we
is,
had two finger piers when you and I were junior.
Right, four and five and eight and nine and were eight still nine. There. Yep.
Yeah, but six was gone.
And
then.
Two and three were gone.
Because our submarines were wider
Way
than
too
the
big.
Submarines.
Yep. Much
so
bigger.
So take out the middle one.
Yep. Yeah. So this is Bofin's crew.
So is this Griffith?
That is Tyree, Alec Tyree. He was okay. The last wartime CO.
Mm-hmm.
And so the officers are here. Chief's down here on this other side. You can see a couple of, we're probably stewards.
Mm-hmm.
And whole crew. But, you know, this picture, look at all these young men.
Yeah.
This was the ANAV. I met him before he passed away at 98.
Wow.
And I mentioned this was the A-ganger, the really big A-ganger.
Oh,
look
yeah,
how
yeah.
big that guy is.
With the wrench?
Yeah, that was the guy with the big monkey wrench.
Uh-huh.
You can see smoke, guys blowing smoke circles. But, you know, there's the home, top of the Homeward Bound pennant.
Right, right.
And the battle flag's above the picture, but you can see all the claimed sinkings.
Yep.
There's another boat with pennants flying over here, too. So this is late August, 45.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even imagine what Pearl Harbor looked like at that point. You know, how many boats are coming in.
No. No.
And
you know, one of the things, obviously, there were about 250 ships anchored in Tokyo Bay when the Missouri came in September for the signing peace treaty. I wonder if there were any submarines.
Yeah, there is. We'll get to the end of the gallery here. I'll
show
great. You. Yeah,
thanks.
There's something there.
All right, good.
Yep. So a lot of this video was filmed. If we wait to cycle through, there's actually some from when... Wahoo came in
from
our third war patrol. You know, you can tell they're acting in everything.
Some
video, I think a lot of this you can find on YouTube, but you know, that's taken from the dive tower there. This is actually the eight ships from the Sea of Japan coming in on the 4th of July, 1945.
After they returned
from the minefields.
Right.
And
then there's a movie Destination Tokyo with Mush Morton. Is reported to have been technical advisor to, and then he died before the movie was released.
Yeah.
He's not credited in the movie anywhere. So you watch the movie, it doesn't say technical. In fact, because another submariner's name, technical advisor. I wonder if that's because he was dead by the time.
Could be.
So I see him in this video too, right?
Yeah, we have some video. This is some probably post-war stuff here, too, that training films. But there you see the vents being, there's the maneuvering room, and they sacrificed a camera topside to get that view in those days.
Last man down, half secure.
Yep, there's the...
Yep.
Very cool.
Well, it submerges a lot faster than us.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Yeah.
So we've set up a couple of stations in here of what it was like to operate the sonar system.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of see as you rotate, that would rotate the hydrophone around, and we have it programmed with some different sounds so you can hear. Similarly, the same array listening up on that station to manually steer it around.
Mm-hmm. That was the receive array.
Yep.
Okay. Whose Navy Cross is this?
Griffith.
Okay.
That's Griffith's Navy Cross from Bofin.
Yeah.
And they...
Navy Cross right there.
Navy Cross. Mm-hmm. That was Griffith, and he wasn't sea. He was sea of a Bullhead, but after he left Bullhead, she was the last submarine lost.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew, you know, almost everybody.
Yeah.
And I guess he suffered personally for many, many years after that.
Now, in the boat, you talked about those bolts. These are the bolts.
Here. Right. Those are,
these are how you set torpedo depth, torpedo speed, torpedo course.
Right.
While the torpedo is in the tube.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's the...
Here's the lever here where when it cocked.
Yeah. And that snaps from this position to that position.
Yep.
And after the torpedo's impulsed out, and that's how it starts the engines, essentially.
Yep. Yep. So here's a battery cell, single battery cell from the era.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But this is shorter than a normal battery cell, isn't it?
Well, this was a from World War II era.
Okay.
I think our modern one was a little bit bigger.
About 6 feet, our modern one.
Yeah. But basically this was it, 120 of those in each battery cell for Bowfin, or I think they went to 126 on later boats.
Times two, because there's
two of them, two batteries. There's a piston from a diesel engine, and for comparison, a modern V8 truck engine. So.
Yeah, no, I've had my engines apart, 16 cylinders on the nuclear submarines, right? Opposed pistons.
So, right.
Yeah. Now, whose sword is this?
This is Red Ramage's sword and Dolphin's and Warp Patrol pin.
He's the one surviving skipper that I never met. Medal of Honor recipient, skipper. The Street, O'Kane, and Flucky I met over the course of my career. Red Ramage I never did.
So that was there's a picture. They're holding that life ring. Mm-hmm. You can see the life ring there that had come off a vessel that they had sunk. Mm-hmm. And when the museum originally opened in the late 80s, we had his Medal of Honor, and it was stolen.
Stolen?
Stolen in the late 80s. Never recovered. Pretty bad.
That's cool.
This display shows some artifacts from the Tang, and that's Dick O'Kane's medal.
Dick O'Kane's Medal of Honor.
And then this was a fairly famous picture that was in papers around the country. He set the record for the most air crew rescued on any one patrol.
Those are the pilots that he rescued.
Yep.
Right. Some happy guys right there.
Yep.
Now, you talked about these, the battle flags for the submarines. Anything remarkable here? I mean, there's some classics.
These are some pretty amazing. I mean, there was no rules or regulations for any of this, right? So it was, they were left to their own devices with what materials they had. Mm-hmm. They all had a sewing machine like that, and whatever materials and scraps and whatever skills they might have had to come up with. So they were pretty imaginative. These are some of the more colorful ones that we have in the collection.
Now, there's some in the squadron office and squadron building on subbase. Mm-hmm. Are those originals?
No, I think those are all replicas.
Okay.
Yeah. And these are all replicas here, too, the originals we have protected.
I would imagine,
A lot of them, once they were, happy with it, then they went to a company and they mass-produced stuff for the crew. Okay. But this video cycles through and really shows the extent of the effectiveness, so it'll reset here to the beginning of the war in a minute. But it starts with, we'll let it cycle through. So these came, ships sunk and war patrols. So it'll reset here to the beginning of the war here on this next one. But it shows, shows Japan's expansion and our start of war patrols. We start to hit a few sinkings. We get more more ships.
They're really scattered out pretty well in the South Pacific.
Yep.
And, of course, sea lanes that go to supply Japan.
That's right.
There's a large concentration there.
Right. And then,
Malaya and
Iowa. Right. And then, by the end of 44, we've got, look at all the submarines we have. And then in 45, things really dried up because we had been so effective.
Vietnam is empty. Yeah, Taiwan Straits a few. That's where Tang went down, right?
Yep.
It's a great way to display it.
Right. Then we talk a little bit about the rescue side of things, too, and it never ceases to amaze me to watch this. I cycle through this video. I've got George Bush talks about him being rescued, and the Finback actually had a camera running. So there's
when they pick him up.
So there's actually the video footage. And it'll cycle through here. It amazes me, all the things he talks about doing wrong. How matter of factly, Any one of the things could have killed him. You know,
yeah, that's right. Chichijima is where his shotgun.
Yeah, and yeah, had he, and you can actually see the island in the background of that video. Yeah, if you want, we can watch this. It's
when I was in jail on Indianapolis. I did three tours on Indy. He came aboard as vice president for a tour, and he said, "This is the second time I've been on a submarine."
Yeah.
And soon it was a lot of smoke.
When we were at the aviation museum, we'd look at the airplane. See how difficult it was going to be for his crew members to get out.
Oh, yeah.
It is not surprising that he did not survive.
Yeah.
And I knew I was in serious trouble. I saw that I couldn't possibly fly this plane back to the ship.
Yes, engine was
all happening very fast. I made an exit from the plane, dove out onto the wing, did it very badly. I pulled the ripcord too soon. I hit my head on the tail of the horizontal stabilizer of the PBF. And a glancing blow like this, and bleeding like a stuck pig. And the parachute momentarily hung up on the tail of the plane and ripped out some of the panels of the chute. So I fell faster than I normally would have. But I failed to put my seat back on. My life boat onto the parachute. So fighter plane came, dove down, showed me where that was, and I swam over, got into this life raft, and started paddling as fast as I could to go out to sea. The wind was blowing towards Chichi, and I was blowing towards Chichi also. I swam as fast as I could. I was sick to my stomach. I was scared. And I wondered what happened to my crewman. And suddenly I saw this periscope, like a little U.S. submarine got me aboard. If they weren't otherwise occupied, it'd be a submarine. And they'd check in somewhere and say, "We're in this area." So when I went down, there was this skipper in my squadron. Used that frequency to tell whatever submarine was listening. This is the pilot's cabin. Here's where he is. It came alongside and picked me up.
So you can see the island in the background back there.
Yeah.
Back down again.
Pretty close to the island.
Earlier from Iwo Jima, I think it was, or Hakajima, which was another island there. And then me. And then after I was safely on board, we went in and pulled another guy out. And some deckmen at the Enterprise. And it was very lucky the submarine was there because, as I said, this boat was going south, and I knew that I would be, if somebody didn't pick me up, I would have been captured and killed. They were very brutal.
Incredible.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. So this was a late addition to our museum. It's worth talking a little bit about. One of Bofin's attacks turned out sank a ship that was carrying school children from Okinawa in advance of the invasion. Mm-hmm. After what had happened in Saipan and Tinian with all the suicides,
right. The
Imperial Japan didn't want that sort of thing to happen again, so they were evacuating civilians and children off of Okinawa. And unknowing to Bofin at the time, it was a legal target.
Mm-hmm.
She sank that ship, and survivors were sworn to secrecy, never to reveal what had happened, because Imperial Japan was worried about the outcry in the country for that thing. So they were sworn to secrecy, and finally many years later some of the survivors spoke up, and there's actually a small museum in Okinawa that commemorates this. And we got a request, we took a hard look at it, we felt we had a good place for it here. So we developed this with the local Okinawan community, put this together. And we've had Okinawan school children here, and they've seen this display. Mm. It's been very well received.
No, it's good. You know, it's important to reflect the war in all of its brutality and all of its tragedy. And
right.
This was not intentional.
Right.
Other submarines sunk ships carrying prisoners of war.
Right.
Right? And so, you know, it's important that we not
gloss over
right.
the true impact of war.
Right.
Because, you know.
Absolutely.
All of the lessons learned, not just some of them.
That's right. You know, and here's an example. This is the Grunion. They're having their farewell party in June of 42, mm-hmm. and she's lost on her first patrol off mm-hmm. up in the Aleutian chain. Mm-hmm. So all these ladies were widows mm-hmm. just a few months after this picture was taken.
Yeah. This is the quote of Nimitz here. We shall never forget our submariners that held the lines against the enemy while our fleets would face losses and repaired wounds.
Yep.
We talk a lot about that in our podcast, that it was the naval aviation and the submarines.
Right.
Because the surface force was essentially decimated
right.
here in Pearl Harbor, and it took a while to recover.
Right.
But naval aviation and submarines got the job done while
right.
those fleets were able to recover.
So this picture was taken on September 2nd, 1945, on the Yokosuka Naval Base. This is all the submarine officers that were present in Yokosuka for the surrender. This is Admiral Lockwood mm-hmm. here in the middle. And when he took command of Sub-PAC in early 43, he sent a message out to his captains, and he said, I look forward to joining you for a drink at the submarine base Yokosuka Officers Club after we've whipped the Japanese. So there were 12 submarines and a submarine tender. There's a picture of the Proteus where there are 12 submarines over there. We can get a shot of that on the way out. But these men came in preparation. They went ashore, disabled weapons, made sure there were no booby traps, mm-hmm. cleaned up areas. You know, some of the stories of what they found ashore was just atrocious,
right.
you know, the sanitation. And they basically came back to the tender at night, stripped off their clothes and burned them because they were just covered in bugs mm-hmm. and everything. But after the ceremony on the Missouri, Admiral Lockwood came ashore. These are probably his senior staff officers, mm-hmm. captains. This is Joe Vasey, who was a longtime Hawaii resident, passed away just shy of his 101st birthday. I was at his 100th birthday party. This is John McCain's father, who was a submarine commander. He was actually the captain of the ship that this guy was XO of, and he was a four-star admiral when his son was a prisoner of war in Vietnam.
Right, he was Sink Pack.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's an incredible photo.
Yeah.
Now, like you, I've probably been to Yokosuka a dozen times.
Many times, yeah.
And I do not remember this arch. I don't know where this photograph is taken.
Yeah, no idea where the building is. I mean, even the last time I was there, the only building of any recognition was the building that the sanctuary was in.
Yep.
And it was, I don't know, maybe it's gone now. I have no idea. They put a parking lot on one side of that building, mm-hmm. and that parking lot has proximity alarms around the corners. So from 4 in the morning to 8 in the morning, you hear those
alarms going off
in that building.
And there was a radio, the naval telemetry station there.
Yeah.
But the other thing Nimitz did right away, as soon as we were occupied, naval station Yokosuka, was protect Admiral Togo's ship mm-hmm. from being, you know,
right. Right.
vandalized.
Right.
Because he had got to know Togo a bit mm-hmm. and had respect for him.
Right.
Because Togo was long dead before World War II began.
Right. Mikasa.
Mikasa.
Yeah.
That's it.
Andy.
And then, you know, I guess the last point is, sometime while you and I were on active duty, they unsealed a chamber on Yokosuka Naval Station, and they found a bunch of remains of human beings that had been sealed in this chamber. It was later determined to be Korean, quote-unquote, laborers, slaves. Not known why. I think this was in the 90s when they discovered this chamber. Not known why. His laborers were killed mm-hmm. in that fashion.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed at the time that the event didn't receive wider attention in Japan.
Yeah, I didn't know about that. All I know is you walk around the base and there's all kind of off-limits signs. You're not allowed to go into a lot of caves.
Right.
I mean, from the sanctuary, you can see caves bored into the side of the hills and everything, and
most of them sealed.
Right. But yeah, it's pretty amazing. And all that was off limits, not allowed to go into any of that stuff. So,
right.
Yep. Yeah, I have no idea where that building was. I think almost anything that was there when you and I would have visited it all been modernized. Like I said, the last time I was there, the sanctuary building was there, but its days may well have been numbered.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so this final picture here is the submarines and the submarine tender that was in Tokyo Bay for the surrender.
This is an interesting morgue, right? So the tender is anchored, and all of these submarines are moored to the tender,
rested
to the tender. And that had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
6 on each side.
That's right, 12. It's incredible with the CO's name.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them were commanders late in the war.
Right.
Rather than lieutenant commanders, but a few lieutenant commanders. Wow, what a photo. So you answered my question.
Yeah.
I didn't know we had submarines anchored in the bay during the signing. And now I know.
Yep.
Good.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right. So the Kaiten was the submerged kamikaze weapon. Mm. So forward end of this was a 3,000-pound warhead, this whole bit of it. And then there was a operating station here in the middle, this small sail. It had a periscope in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the aft end of it was the fuel tank and engine for this weapon.
Because the pilot, the guy who's committing suicide, had to see where he's going. There's no guidance, so it's not like they would run deep. They would run
right up the surface.
Periscope death right at the surface.
Right.
And Japanese submarines, the I-class, often carried 6 of these things topside. And in fact, there's the I-58 that sunk the Indianapolis, Ned Beach, in the opening to Hashimoto's book, the English edition of Hashimoto's book, says that he doesn't believe Hashimoto when he says he sunk the Indianapolis with torpedoes. He believes that Hashimoto used Kaiten.
Hmm.
And it wasn't until 2017, when we found the Indianapolis, did we know with certainty Hashimoto was telling the truth. He did not use Kaiten to sink the Indianapolis. But the Kaiten, but he had 6 Kaiten that were launched sometime during that patrol. These, once launched, this guy's going to
Oh, yeah, he's done.
He's not going to come back.
Yep. Once the hatch was shut, he couldn't open the hatch. The pilot couldn't open the hatch. This was a dangerous weapon. I mean, there were several. Even the inventor died in an accident.
Mm-hmm.
So there were co-inventors, and the lead advocate was a fairly young naval officer. He died in the training, and the other guy carried his ashes when they carried the attack on the Mississauga, and that guy also perished, but that was one of the few successful uses of this weapon.
Mississauga and the Underhill.
Yep.
Late in the war, I think that was.
But that was it. So
June
it was
or July of 1945.
Yeah. So it was a desperation weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Once they launched, they had a compass. We may not have it in here. And they would basically just maintain a DR. They knew they were going to go a certain distance. They could throttle the engine so they could control their range a little bit, but they also had a device where they could self-detonate their weapon if they failed in their mission. They could just at least kill themselves and detonate the weapon, but very little in terms of control and...
Like the midget submarines, this rudder is tiny.
Right. Yeah, that's what we can walk.
And so he's not going to be able to turn tight.
Right.
Is he going to get into a tail chase?
Right.
Eventually, unless he leads the target.
Right.
He's leading the target ship. If he fails do that, he's going to end up in a tail chase.
Right.
And if he can't turn fast enough, he's going to miss.
Right.
That's good.
Yeah.
We can pick up, we were talking about the rudder and its stern.
Sure. This is kind of a cutaway, shows the engine mount, but this used liquid, oxygen propulsion, you know, which, you know, we knew the Kursk had a torpedo that blew up, right? So same sort of technology that the Japanese mastered. They knew how to keep things clean enough. You had to have pure. You had to have pure, and you had to have good piping, and they figured out the technology to make this all work. But the pilot could control the speed to somewhat, but then once he was lined up for his attack, he would run at maximum speed right into the target. And the Mississauga was at anchor, so it wasn't a moving target. So
The Underhill was underway, I think, when it got sunk.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't going fast.
Yep.
Yeah, because these weren't very... was it 35 knots?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
They were relative, 35, 40 or so in that max speed. But but again, yeah, like you said, the control surface is not...
Yeah, the stern planes are actually pretty beefy here. But, you know, again, these rudders look like they're big, but this is a cutaway of the vertical stabilizer, and it's just, that's not going to create a lot of turbulence to kick this massive piece of steel around.
Right.
So, yeah, they seem, I don't know why, they did it on both the Kaiten and the Glad and the midget submarines now.
Right.
One midget submarine we know with certainty got into Pearl Harbor during the attack. One that was sunk on the west side of Fort Island, I-22 Tau. So it was good enough, I guess.
You had to be lucky.
Had to be lucky, yeah. Right, and that pilot of that midget was the... lieutenant was the instructor.
Oh, so yeah, again, like that Mississauga attack, he was one of the developers, right? So he had the most time and the training and...
Well, thanks, Chuck.
You're welcome. Do you have anything on the cutie?
No.
We've got a cutie over here.
Okay.
We can
do
it's
that.
Right there.
Keep rolling then, honey.
Okay, Mark 27, though, now.
Yeah.
So this was one of the first homing weapons developed. So if you look up here on the nose, the sensor's gone, but this actually was a passive acoustic sensor.
And it was used during World War II.
Used during World War II, and you'll see these got some extensions on the body of this thing because it was a 19-inch weapon. So these were added so that it fit in the 21-inch tube. And it was a battery-powered weapon, small warhead. But what this was designed to do was for if a ship was under attack, depth charge attack, they would launch these out of the aft tube, and it would spiral up. And it was looking for the cavitation from the attacking craft and home on that and detonate. And it wasn't a huge warhead, but it was enough to cause damage. And there's a number of sinkings credited to these weapons.
Mark 27 cuties. Yeah,
and they call it a cutie because they could carry two of them in one load line for the Mark 14 or 18. It was battery powered, so they had to, like the Mark 18, so they had to have battery chargers to keep the batteries. And like I said, it did a spiral maneuver, and if it detected something, it ran up and...
We're still trying to break the code on wake-homing torpedoes during the Cold War, and we had an early version of one during World War II.
That's right.
Incredible. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, Chuck, I wanted to thank you for taking us on this tour of the BOFIN and the Pacific Submarine Force Museum. These are incredible treasures for anybody interested in World War II.
Yep.
And I encourage anybody who comes to Pearl Harbor, you got to see this place, right? You can't talk about World War II without talking about submarines, and this is the best place, the best submarine museum in the United States, in my opinion. Yep.
Thanks.
I hope you agree.
Thanks. No, I think it's, BOFIN, only about 15 fleet boats left, and some of those are really threatened. We're fortunate that we're in a good position. We're going to keep BOFIN safe and suitable for as long as we physically can.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
You too.
We've already visited the Submarine Force Pearl Harbor Museum, and I said no visit to Pearl Harbor would be complete without a visit there. Well, similarly, no visit to Pearl Harbor would be complete without a visit to the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum. Okay, Captain Bill Toady here at the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum
And I'm so pleased to have our docent Eric Pradel with us here today. He's an expert on all the World War II stuff. Now, let me tell you, folks, if you make it to Hawaii, you got to visit the Arizona. It's a solemn place, you know, and you got to go there. I said before, you got to visit the boat fin and the submarine museum of the Pacific. And this is the third must-see museum, the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum. There's so much good stuff, not just World War II related, but of course today we're going to be focusing on the World War II related stuff.
Definitely.
Is that right, Eric?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. This great old sign is very symbolic, but this is a sign that was frequently shown to sailors in the 1930s and 1940s to get them to be willing to come out here and serve in Pearl Harbor. It doesn't have much to do with the Navy. It's a great sign.
Yeah, it's a great one. It's an iconic sign that many people are familiar with.
Yeah. Good. All right, so we're going to walk down this way, and we're going to start looking around. So when we talk about the attack on Pearl Harbor, there is no more iconic aircraft than the one that's behind us. Mm-hmm. You want to tell us about this, Eric?
Yeah, so this aircraft right here is a Mitsubishi A6M20 fighter, the primary fighter aircraft of the Imperial Navy throughout the war. They had several models of it, but this is the A6M2 version of it, same version that they used here at Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and this is not an airplane that flew in the attack on Pearl Harbor, right?
No.
Yeah, but if there's no other reason for you to come to the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum, this is enough to draw you here just by itself. This, you know, there are times during my podcast where I kind of talk about the Wildcat and its inferiority compared to the Zero. And honestly, some of our viewers have gotten on me for that. They say I'm a little hard on the Wildcat. And, you know, even though they'll admit the Hellcat was a better airplane.
Yeah.
How did this airplane perform vis-a-vis the Wildcat? Now, we also talk about things like the thatch weave, right, that our pilots learned to do to overcome the deficiencies. But there were other things that the pilots could do to overcome the deficiencies of the airplanes?
Yeah, so one of the best-known tactics that U.S. pilots used was the thatch weave, the weaving back and forth so you can defend the back end of your wingman. But that's because the Zero had a tendency to turn quicker than U.S. aircraft did at that time. They have large control surfaces, which allowed it to turn much tighter at slower speeds. But at higher speeds, they lost that maneuverability. Mm-hmm. Around 200 to 250 miles an hour, they started to lose the ability to turn to the right. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. found that out by recovering one that crashed in Alaska in June of 1942. Mm-hmm. So another tactic that several pilots would use is they'd use what we call here at the museum the boom and zoom tactic. They'd come in over the top, try and dive down on them, try and shoot them down that way, and if you don't, keep diving. And when you get to that critical speed point and you're close enough to the ground to safely turn to the right, try turning to the right, and if that Zero tries to follow you, they
maybe
might just crash right into the ground.
Drink.
Yep.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah.
So how many of these Zeros in this condition do you think still exist in the world?
In this condition, this one's actually still flight-worthy. It's still classified as flight-worthy when it arrived here at the museum, and there were only about seven of them at the time.
Holy cow.
I believe there's 12 of them on display, I believe.
Around the world?
Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah.
This is a beautiful airplane, and you can understand, you know, why we had such trouble with it in the early phases of the war. Mm-hmm. But, of course, over the course of war, that did change.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we know of several Zeros during the attack on Pearl Harbor that did end up crashed around the island. In fact, there was a rumor when I was a junior officer here, we would bushwhack through the hills of Aiea because there was a story that there was one crashed up there. There was a crashed airplane, but I never found evidence that it was actually a Zero. But there was one crashed on the island of Niihau, wasn't there?
Yes.
Yeah. And for those of you who aren't Kama'aina Hawaiian residents, Niihau is a closed island. It's privately owned. And for years and years, for decades, only native Hawaiians could live on that island. Mm-hmm. But there were two or three Japanese living on the island at the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened? Tell us the story.
Yeah, so the wreckage that we have behind us is actually wreckage of the Zero that crash landed there. And it was piloted by a young Japanese pilot, Airman First Class Shigenori Nishikaichi, who was involved in the second wave of the attack over Kaneohe Naval Air Station, that area. Got a few bullets to his wings, hit the fuel tanks, was leaking fuel.
And they didn't have the self-sealing
tanks. Yep, they did not have self-sealing tanks like American planes had, yeah. So he remembered his briefing. He was leaking too much fuel, knew he wouldn't be able to make it back to his aircraft carrier to the north. So his briefing that morning told him, if you can't make it back to your carrier, you can take a shorter flight to a flat, dry lake bed on the island of Niihau. Little did the Imperial Fleet know, though, the owners of that island, the Robinson family, went out and in the late 1930s, early 1940s, picked up a tractor, which we have on display here, and started cutting up that lake bed in a tic-tac-toe type fashion with four-foot-deep furrows to prevent that lake bed from being used as an airfield.
Wow.
Yeah. And they were tipped off that that lake bed could be used as an airfield from a report that came out in 1924 by General Billy Mitchell.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So the Japanese pilot crash lands on that lake bed. It's not a flat lake surface anymore.
No.
So the airplane breaks apart. He gets knocked out.
Yep.
What happens then?
Yeah, so he was knocked out. The locals came up, opened up the cockpit, got him out, nursed him back to consciousness. They didn't have a working radio at that time, so they didn't know what was going on here at the island of Oahu and Pearl Harbor. So they nursed him back to consciousness, threw him a welcome luau that evening, and he stayed on that island for about a week. But over the next few days, they started to get bits and pieces on what was going on over here. So they placed the pilot, Nishikaichi, into house arrest to be taken care of until the military or authorities could come out and take him into custody. Well, in that time, though, one of the local Japanese-Americans who lived on the island, Mr. Harada, worked for the Robinsons, so he was able to live there on the island as well, was put under his care as an interpreter. So they could find out more of what was going on and use him to find out what the pilot was saying. And at one point, they were left alone, and the pilot talked to Mr. Harada and said, hey, can we find my pistol and papers that were taken away when I crashed? So they went into another house to find that, found the pistol, didn't find the papers, also found a shotgun and took several people captive. Two of these people were Ben Kanahele and his wife Ella, two native Hawaiians that lived on the island. And Mr. Kanahele is a big guy. He's a sheep shearer by trade.
Many Hawaiians are.
Yeah. And didn't really like being held captive at all, like most people wouldn't. So at one point, he rushes at the pilot to overtake him, but the pilot pulls his pistol and he shot him three times. Once in chest, once in the stomach, and once in the leg. But small caliber pistol slowed him down a little bit, but he kept rushing at him, got to the pilot. They wrestled with each other a little bit. Eventually, Mr. Kanahele picks the pilot up, threw him against a rock wall, knocking him out yet again. And to finish off the pilot, Mr. Kanahele's wife, Ella, a little bit upset about her husband being shot three times, picked up a large rock and dropped it right on the pilot's head.
That killed him.
Yep.
Yeah, so, the whole bit about the Japanese-American aiding and comforting the enemy here, although they weren't quite sure what was going on in Oahu at the time, if those of you that do internet research may see something along the lines of that aid and assistance was used as justification for the imprisonment of Japanese Americans on mainland United States. And in fact, if you look through the actual documents that record the conversations that led to that policy, I see no evidence that they ever even talked about the Harada, right?
Yeah.
The Harada case and the aid that Harada gave to this Japanese pilot. So I think those are completely unrelated. If you see that on the internet, you should discount it. It was a policy that was born in error and should never have been done. And this certainly wasn't justification for it.
Yeah. I've seen no connection between the two as well in all my research. So, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric. So, Eric, you don't just have Navy and Marine Corps airplanes here at the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum.
Yep.
You also have Army airplanes. No surprise there. But there's something different about this airplane.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, so we got a Army B-25 Mitchell bomber on the deck of an aircraft carrier.
Yeah. So we're talking about the Doolittle Raid here. Now, we talk about the Doolittle Raid on our podcast.
Yeah.
And I talked about the fact that Jimmy Doolittle, when he lived in Carmel, California, and I was in Monterey going to graduate school, I got to meet. And what a legend that guy is. And when you see the size of this airplane, It's about the size of an A3D whale, a more modern jet airplane, but propellers, right?
Yep.
And the fact that they can get this thing up to takeoff speed and rotate on the deck of the Hornet, when you see it, you say, nah, it can't be done. But as we know, they did it. So what about this airplane specifically should we know about?
With this one on our deck here, it's got a very special piece to it right here on the wheel well cover of the nose gear. And we have two signatures of Doolittle Raiders themselves.
Come on up.
We have a signature of Richard Cole, co-pilot for Doolittle's plane number one, and also Tom Griffin, who I believe was a navigator on plane number seven.
Plane number seven.
Yep.
So two actual Doolittle Raiders. Now, those guys obviously they survived the war.
Yep.
They both crash-landed in China. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And, I can imagine they had some incredible stories to tell.
Yeah. And they both signed this aircraft on the opening day of this museum.
Is that right?
Yep.
Now, were either of them taken prisoner, or did they both get out?
To be honest, I'm not too sure.
Well,
I know. With Richard Cole, I believe he got out. I'm not too sure about Tom Griffin.
Yeah. Again, so many iconic pieces here at the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum that just must be seen by any true lover of World War II history. Okay. So, Dauntless.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows the Dauntless from the Battle of Midway, right?
Yeah.
But it predates Midway. Mm-hmm. We had Dauntless flying at Coral Sea. Can you tell us about this airplane?
Yeah, so this airplane right here is an SBD-2, the P variant, so photo reconnaissance variant. There were only about 14 of this type built for photo reconnaissance.
Mm-hmm.
But this one delivered to the Navy spring of 1941, flew photo reconnaissance off the Enterprise for a little bit. Then it wound up at an aircraft pool in San Diego, California.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it was on December 7th during the attack here. Mm-hmm. Then eventually in January of 42, it wound up right here on an aircraft pool on Ford Island.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in spring of 42, it was loaded on the deck of the USS Yorktown, which made its way down to the Coral Sea area. And this aircraft was on the Yorktown at Coral Sea. I haven't been able to find out if it actually flew up into the skies at the battle, but we do know it is one of the few aircraft that was able to fly off of the Yorktown when it was coming into Pearl Harbor here for the 3 days of repairs after it was damaged at Coral Sea.
Yeah, which is, again, another incredible story.
Yeah.
Stuff of legend, his involvement, and get the Yorktown turned around so it could show up at the Battle of Midway.
Yep.
So I assume that when Yorktown got underway for the Battle of Midway, this airplane wasn't on board.
This aircraft was not on board at that point. When it flew off, it was replaced with another set of aircraft. It stayed here on Ford Island for a little bit and then was transferred to training squadrons on the mainland.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, we talk a lot in the podcast about the pilot and the gunner.
Yep.
We're going to show that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But this, remember, these gunners were facing rearward as you know, trying to shoot airplanes behind them. And you can imagine what that was like when they were in the dive.
Yeah.
I can't even begin to imagine what this would have been like.
Yeah, I couldn't either. I mean, it'd be a ride of a lifetime.
It would,
yeah.
A roller coaster like never experienced.
Oh, yeah.
Life or death roller coaster.
Yeah,
somehow, Eric, I left the impression with some of our viewers that I'm hating on the Wildcat, the F4F. I am not hating on the Wildcat. I just did say what the pilots themselves said early in the war, which is that they needed a better airplane, which they eventually got with the Hellcat.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a Wildcat, and we, just so you know, we did do an episode on the Cactus Air Force and talked about Wildcats flying out of Guadalcanal. We did a bunch of episodes on Guadalcanal, but one specifically on the Cactus Air Force. So can you talk to us about this airplane?
Yeah, so this is our F4F 3 variant of it. This is only one of, I believe, two F4F3s with fixed wings on it. This one was used as a training qualification carrier landing aircraft, so it didn't need the folding wings.
Yeah.
So it's actually got fixed wings on it.
Well, it didn't need it on Guadalcanal either.
No,
But most of the Wildcats, if I'm not mistaken, they got to Guadalcanal, got there off of a carrier.
Yeah.
So they would have needed them for the carrier.
Yep.
Design, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
This one on our floor here has an interesting backstory to it. It was, as I mentioned, a training aircraft on carrier qualifications. and it wound up at the bottom of Lake Michigan in 1943, I believe it was. June of 43, it went into the lake, and it was brought up from the bottom in December of 1991, January of 1992.
Wow. Yeah. Well, the Great Lakes are really cold.
Really cold.
And not salt water. Yeah. And if they get deep enough, they don't have a lot of oxygen, so they won't corrode.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and this
so
was about 250 feet down, I believe it was, or somewhere around there. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was basically functional when it was brought up as well.
Now, the deck here that we're talking about, come on up and let's see the deck, because we talk about this as well on Guadalcanal, because it was a mud pit.
Yeah.
And so how do we overcome that?
To overcome that, our construction battalions, airfield makers, basically went out, leveled it out as much as they could, and laid this matting down to give some structure to that surface that they were on and being able to take off and land.
Yeah, it helped some, but it wasn't 100%.
No.
It still had issues with mud on Guadalcanal throughout the war, even where we had many, many airfields that were using it basically as a training base later.
Yeah.
So, wow, a wildcat, but not with folding wings.
Yeah.
So, Eric, we recently did an episode on VMF 214, the Black Sheep Squadron, and actually I learned a few things from viewers during the feedback on that episode, but of course that's where the famous Marine Corps pilot Pappy Boynton, the squadron that he commanded. But before he commanded VMF 214, he was a member of the Flying Tigers in China. So what can you tell us about this airplane?
Yeah, so this aircraft right here is a P-40 Warhawk, and this is the type of aircraft that the Flying Tigers were using over in China.
Yeah.
And this one right here, is painted up exactly how they would have been painted.
Is that right?
Yeah.
For Flying Tigers?
Yep, for Flying Tigers. Got the Flying Tiger logo right there. Uh-huh. Got the Hells Angels squadron painted on the front end as well. Right. One of their three squadrons.
How about that? Yeah. Yep. So I think Pappy's boss in Tigers, his name is Chenault.
Yep.
And Pappy definitely got credited for two air-to-air kills while in the Flying Tigers.
Yeah.
And tried to take credit for two air-to-ground kills.
Yep.
And Chenault, neither Chenault nor the Marine Corps would give him credit for those two air-to-ground kills. Yeah. As I joked in the episode, if air-to-ground kills worked, an artilleryman could become aces, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, who's the photo of here?
So this photo in the back is a group of Flying Tiger pilots sitting on one of their aircraft.
How's that right? What if Pappy's in that photo?
I'm not too sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So we have not yet done an episode on the Battle of Chichijima. Where a famous American was shot down.
Yep.
And that famous American has some history with this airplane here. Doesn't look like a World War II airplane, does it?
No.
But go ahead and give us that history.
So this aircraft here is a Boeing Stearman, also known as Yen 2S3 in naval terms, or the PT-17 Cadet in Army terms. This was one of the main primary training aircraft of World War II for the United States. So most pilots flying up in the skies for the U.S. learned how to fly airplanes on one just like this. And this one on our floor, it's fairly special to us. It's one of the three or four main primary training aircraft of George Herbert Walker Bush himself, the 41st president.
Yeah. Yep. And, of course, George H.W. Bush, right here is his photograph, was shot down at the Battle of Chichijima, survived.
Yep.
Yep. Picked up by a submarine, I might add, the USS Finback.
Yep.
We submariners are very proud of that.
Oh, yeah.
And he actually toured my submarine, the USS Indianapolis, not while I was CO, but when I was junior officer, and I got his autograph then.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about, I think he said to me at the time that this was only the second time he'd been on a submarine, and this time was better than the first.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, wait a minute. You were rescued the first time, but I think he was thinking about the fact he had been shot down.
Yeah.
And so, So this was actually not a replica, but this is actually one of the planes that he
We have the log books with the matching tail numbers and bureau numbers of this aircraft as
well.
So
he actually flew this airplane.
Yep.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, Eric, this might not have been a combat aircraft, but it was one of the most extremely important aircraft throughout the conduct of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us why?
Yeah, so this is a C-47. This is what was used to transport most of the equipment, most of the troops around.
Mm-hmm.
Paratroopers, iconic aircraft from D-Day.
Yeah.
Paratroopers jumping out of these, transported troops around the South Pacific as well. equipment used as a flying laundry mat, pretty much. Chaplains getting them to the people out at the front. But it could be used for anything, pretty much, that you needed. Later on in Vietnam, put a whole bunch of guns in it, made it into a gunship as well.
Nice and slow and low, right?
Yeah.
Wow. It's incredible. One of the last tail draggers that I guess we flew during the Vietnam War. I think the OV-1 was observation aircraft was a tail dragger as well. But this airplane's in remarkable shape.
Oh, yeah.
Where'd it come from?
We actually acquired it from the airport, Honolulu International Airport.
Really? Yeah. They had it?
They had it over there. It was flying up until the early 2000s, I believe, with a cargo company over there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Erica, during my tenure here in Pearl Harbor, which has lasted quite a long time, the control tower here on Ford Island was in great jeopardy.
Oh, yeah.
It was falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy was trying to use appropriate funds to fix it. And year after year after year, there's their military construction funds. They would get removed from the budget and things like that. And there was a period of time when we were worried the sucker might actually fall down.
Yeah.
And like I say, there's the dive tower on submarine base and this control tower on Ford Island. They're important for a bunch of reasons, not historical, but like they were used as landmarks by the Japanese pilots that were conducting the attack. I'm so happy to see that the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum is now actively using the buildings.
Yep.
When I was here as Commodore, those buildings were abandoned, and they were in really, really bad shape. So can you tell us anything about this?
So we've been working on the operations building complex since, I believe it was 2010 when the project started.
Okay.
Biggest part was the stabilization of the tower. We put over 40 tons of steel into there to stabilize it so it won't fall over.
Great.
Before we started, it looked like a sudden wind gust could blow it over.
Right.
But that project took a little while. We got it repainted. We redid the elevator and the box and the elevator shaft there. And Memorial Day of 2022, we opened it up for tours. So we're taking guests up to the top.
All the way to the
top. To get a bird's eye view of the battlefield here.
Something I've never done, folks. And again, yet another reason you got to come to Hawaii and visit the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum because this is a monument worth seeing. Okay, we talk in the Battle of Midway about the Devastator torpedo bomber and its inadequacy. It was eventually replaced by the Avenger, right? And this is also a torpedo bomber?
Yep.
Okay, you want to talk to us about this airplane?
Yeah, so the TBM Avenger was a torpedo bomber. For the U.S. Navy and Marines flew them as well. And it is the largest and heaviest single-engine propeller aircraft of World War II.
Okay.
Also.
Yeah. It's incredible. And, of course, famously, we talked about a minute ago about George H.W. Bush being shot down, and we showed his training aircraft. But this was the type of airplane he was flying when he was shot down. And were there two or three crewmen on this aircraft?
There were three crew on this aircraft,
Yeah. Different than the dive bombers, right? So the dive bombers had just two, tail gunner. What did the third crewman do?
So you had the pilot, you had a tail gunner, and then radio operator and stinger gunner down below. He had another small machine gun down below.
So he was inside the belly of the airplane. That must not have been a fun place to be.
Probably not, no.
And the case of George H.W. Bush, both of those crewmen died, right?
Yeah.
When he was shot down Battle of Chichijima. That is an incredible, amazing, and very large propeller-driven airplane. So it's great that you have it here.
Yeah.
So, Eric, you said that the Zero was in flyable condition. My guess is that this B-17 is not in flyable condition.
Not quite there, no.
So talk to us about this.
So this aircraft right here is our B-17 Flying Fortress. It's an E model of it. And it's a pretty special B-17. It was completed on the Boeing factory lines on November 28th of 1941. Then it was sent to California for engine testing and was delivered to the U.S. Army on the late afternoon of December 6th of 1941.
Wow.
So this is one of the last pre-war aircraft delivered to the United States before the attack here that next morning.
Now, famously, a squadron of B-17s was supposed to fly to Pearl Harbor, and December 7th, you know, we talked about the story of the radar operator who saw incoming airplanes, and he was told, don't worry about it, right, because it thought that it might be that squadron of B-17s. This was not one of those.
This was not. No, that squadron left before this one was accepted.
Was yeah. accepted.
Yeah.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. So how did you come to have it, and why is it in such bad condition?
Well, it arrived here at Hickam Field on December 17th, 10 days after the attack.
Oh,
on its way to an air depot in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
It arrived here on December 17th, stayed here for about a month and a half, getting the crew trained up, ready to go, doing anti-submarine patrols throughout the islands, things like that. Arrived in Australia on February 20th in 1942, stayed there for 2 days when it left on its first and only combat mission of the war on the evening of February 22nd. They were bombing shipping out of, I think it was Port Simpson out of Rabaul. I believe that's what the port was called. They were bombing shipping out of there, out of Rabaul, flew over the target, dropped its bombs, was heading out of the area. It was the last one of the formation to show up over target, and enemy aircraft were up in the skies. And it got into a little aerial fight with some Zeros as well. Was able to outrun them. When a B-17 is unloaded, it's fairly fast.
Wow.
So it was able to get away from them. They burnt off a little too much fuel, though, and they were going to try and make it to the emergency landing field in Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
But when they got to the island of New Guinea, they found out they were too low on fuel and wouldn't be able to climb over the mountains they had to get over. So they circled around, looked for a nice field to set it down in, brought it down, basically a textbook gear up belly landing, but they found out they were in about a 4 foot deep swamp at that time. Yep. The aircraft had 9 crew members on board at the time. All 9 survived that landing and spent the next several weeks cutting themselves out of the jungles and then going from village to village until they wound up in the hands of the Australian Army.
Right,
yep.
Out of Port Moresby.
Yep.
So the airplane stayed in PNG
yep.
until the end of the war and was recovered?
Yeah, it stayed there, went into the swamps on the early morning of February 23rd of 42, and it stayed in that spot in the swamps until the summer of 2006.
2006.
Yep. Yep. When a crew eventually got to it and basically cut it into the pieces that we see it in today to airlift it out of the swamps by helicopter.
Wow.
And then it stayed there in Papua New Guinea until about 2010. There was some controversy about bringing it out of the country into the United States and back. Some people wanted it to stay there on site.
Museums there.
Some wanted to bring it back to the U.S. Mm. Eventually, in 2010, it made its way to California.
Mm.
And in spring of 2013, made its way here.
Okay.
Yep.
So is there any plans to restore it, or is it going to kind of stay this way?
From what I understand, it's more of a preservation project than a restoration.
I see.
From what we know, it's... the only one with its extensive combat damage still remaining on it, on display. And having it down like this on its belly, it gives a different perspective to the B-17 as well. You don't normally see them down like this.
That's
true. Normally see them up on the gear.
You can see the props are still bent from the landing. And, I'm surprised there's not more aluminum corrosion damage on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually, I can imagine why the windows were burst out and things like that. The bombardier station here. That took a beating
on
that landing,
doubt.
But it's a great, great artifact of that battle.
Oh, definitely.
We talk a lot about Rabaul, and here's an airplane that actually flew combat missions over Rabaul. It's amazing. So we mentioned when we were talking about the control tower, that it's been renovated, and I mentioned that the Navy kept trying to use appropriated funds to restore it, and historical funds, and that kept getting pushed out of the budget.
Yeah.
So how did that finally get funded?
So the museum here got access to the building to start working on it. And the Navy did help with a little bit of the funding of it, I believe. But most of the funding for the restoration project of the tower and most of our aircraft here comes through donations to the museum.
Donations.
Yep.
So it's people like you, folks. Now, Seth and I do this as a labor of love. We don't make money. We spend a lot of money to make this thing happen. We're never going to make a penny on it. The thing you've got to keep in mind is there's no way museums like this or the Submarine Museum of the Pacific, the Bowfin, or the National World War II Museum, or any of these other great museums, Seth's Museum at Camp Shelby, any of these museums could work without your donations. That's what keeps this stuff from falling apart and being rendered, you know, kind of useless, lost to history. So it's really important that everybody do what they can to help support. Don't just believe that World War II history should be learned and kept alive, but do something about it. and find a museum that helps with this kind of stuff and do your part, do whatever you can to help them do what they're doing, because it's great work you're doing.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got a lot out of this. These are important historic sites that should not be lost to our public consciousness. They're as important to America's and really our allies' involvement in World War II as anything we could possibly imagine. So that's it for this week's episode of The Unauthorized History of the Pacific War. I'm Captain Toady, and for Seth Parrott and my partner in crime this week, we're out.